so far.
All right, I'm starting here. Welcome to the Raleigh Bitcoin Meetup. Is a person who does altcoins just so that they can obtain more Bitcoin really an altcoiner, or are they really a Bitcoiner? I think they're really a Bitcoiner, unless they're planning on selling their altcoins for USD. I mean, let's be honest, nobody's buying altcoins with the intention of holding altcoins. So they're all planning on selling. So it's like they're either going to sell for USD or they're going to sell for Bitcoin. If they're planning on selling for Bitcoin, then in their heart, they are Bitcoin maximalists.
Yeah.
Even if you don't believe it.
Dude, if you are buying shit coins and selling for USD, you're just an idiot. Like, I mean, have you learned nothing over the past 11 years? I think that's the way you got to look at it, you know. And it also, to me, it gets to like how honest is the person about what they're doing? Because like, you wanna shitcoin and stack some more Bitcoin. Like, some people are good at doing that. Some people aren't good at doing that. But as long as you know what you're doing, then I'm fine with it. It's when people try to make it seem like their shit is the new Bitcoin, or it's going to replace Bitcoin or something. That's it's just not true. And it's like, it makes them look like they're trying to drop a bag on some noob, you know, and just dump on some noob with their alt that rubs me the wrong way.
I do plan to dump my alts on noobs.
Yeah, of course. I mean, who else is going to buy them?
That's kind of the tuition. Like, you know, a couple of years ago when I was in it, I've always thought that Bitcoin was the first one, but a couple of years ago, I wasn't sure if Ethereum would beat Bitcoin. Like, I really didn't understand it until.
Sounds like you still don't.
Oh, I understand it now. But I'm kidding, dude. Like, after going to all the meetups, I understood why. It's just, I was more convinced on Bitcoin. Before, it was like, okay, maybe Ethereum could beat Bitcoin, or like, I didn't really understand why. Now I understand a lot more.
Because Vitalik doesn't know what the fuck Ethereum is?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know, but on Ethereum,
in my head, I didn't really understand it, you know?
Yeah. So what flips you other than the price? Like, what attributes of Bitcoin? Was it the digital true scarcity or some other quality? What was it?
I guess a lot of different qualities. The scarcity, the decentralization. It's been around the longest.
Do you have a favorite?
Favorite what?
Like, quality of Bitcoin. Or was there one thing that made you turn? Or was it just really the graduating and settling shit? Period
that made me turn. I guess it's still just a conviction where I was like, okay, like, this makes sense. I'm denominating all the other shit coins into Bitcoin. And that made a lot of sense to me instead of going from USD. And also with the idea that eventually US dollars just won't exist. Bitcoin won't be denominated in dollars at a certain point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a similar story I think a lot of people have. They end up selling what shitcoins they do have for Bitcoin because they realize it's the winner. It's one that has the most liquidity, been around the longest, makes sense, is the most liquid. Everyone sells their shitcoins to get more Bitcoin, and you know, they have to use Bitcoin to get their shitcoins, or I guess you can do straight fiat into shit coins, or is it always like Bitcoin being the gatekeeper? I didn't shit coin enough to really.
It depends now that stable coins are around, there's a lot more USD or Tether options, but.
There's a lot more. Yeah. It used to be basically just, if you want to get shit coins, you have to get Bitcoin. And now it's, I think most major exchanges have a USD or USDT. Yeah. That's another thing too.
But it's still, you still have to go to Coinbase or Gemini or Kraken to get one of these stable coins first. So it's the path from somebody with nothing to some altcoins is still through Coinbase, Gemini, Kraken.
Or Robinhood.
But
that's paper Bitcoin.
In Robinhood, can you withdraw USDT?
No, it's all fucking paper, dude.
You can't withdraw Bitcoin. So I don't think Robinhood, you can send coins send money to like an exchange or anything. But does Robinhood sell actual altcoins?
No, I don't think so.
No, they do.
I don't know how the fuck Robinhood works, but you're better off just buying BTC.
Yeah.
I didn't know Robinhood. But they don't let you withdraw.
Robinhood at this point has 18 different altcoins.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
Okay.
I looked at the list that you just sent out, and they definitely have some.
I think there needs to be a distinction made between altcoins and shitcoins. And altcoins you're trading alternative cryptocurrencies, and shitcoiners, you're trading alternative cryptocurrencies and you're working a shitty ass fiat job to try and get Bitcoin. Like there needs to be some distinction, like of the person who's going to work 9th Street downtown Durham and shake their ass to, you know, suck the day's dick, either figuratively or literally, for the purposes of earning money to go buy Bitcoin. That's still a shitcoiner in some regard, because you're having to get, you know, dirty drug US dollars and then turn it into Bitcoin. You know, I think some level of distinction is necessary.
Sucking cock for ETH. That's some hard times,
figuratively,
dude.
Or literally. I mean, it's up to the buyer's choice.
Not that we judge here, but I mean, if you're trying to get shitcoins for that, then yes, we will judge you. But that's how you want to live your life? By all means.
I honestly consider what I do for a living to be like being a shitcoiner. You know, because all that I'm getting
earn fiat, that's all of us. I guess we're all shitcoiners now, guys.
For it. And then I, you know, and I'm only doing that for the purpose of stacking more sats. So is that, you know, the end justifying the means? Kind of, you know, kind of where the conversation was leading in the first place. Does it really matter what I do to get Bitcoin?
Yeah,
so no.
Conversation, I mean, in the first place. I guess it doesn't.
So, like, I was conflicted with this too, because we made the distinction between shitcoiners or people using shitcoins as a means to get more Bitcoin. And then there's the altcoin projects like DigiCoin, or the fuck it is. I think I said it right. I don't know.
Digibyte,
yeah. That's the one. I actually met the dude at a meetup. He's a nice guy, but like, you know, those, you know, whatever. But like, there's nice dudes like that that actually try to make this project and are like well intended, or maybe they're being intellectually dishonest. And then I met Marco Pierborn of Decred, and dude's a sweetheart. And he's awesome. And I've had like Vin Armani on my show a couple times, and you know, him being the Bcash whatever dude. So it's really kind of hard, because you know they've got that bags of Bitcoin as well, but they spin this really convincing rhetoric of what if Bitcoin takes a shit and it just breaks? Well, our coins are gonna fix this because of this. And of course they'll have the wits to prove whatever the case is with code or whatever solution they came up with. So it's hard for me to not kind of feel like a dick saying that they're shitcoin scammers, but then it's also like they're kind of being shitcoin scammers in a way. Like, aside from like whatever merit they have, but like, at the same time, you know, they know Bitcoin's number one and they still feel like Bitcoiners at heart. So like, I'm conflicted with this a little bit. And then there's also the fact, like, we still live in a fiat world. So if people are going to sell their alts for extra cash because they want cash. I mean, right now, who doesn't want cash? I mean, in this group, who doesn't want Bitcoin? Everyone here wants Bitcoin. But then you have to put up with the fact that you're living in the world of fiat. So you still got to pay your shit, your bills, and, you know, treat yourself with fiat as it is. But it's always a plus if you can treat yourself with Bitcoin instead of fiat.
Treat yourself.
I don't know. I went on a rant there. Are y'all able to like dissect my fucking diarrhea mouth?
I think the goal is, you know, we all believe Bitcoin is. Let's suspend our disbelief for a second. And if there is one, if it's possible, the best thing that we can have is Bitcoin. And the ideal for those altcoiners is to beat Bitcoin, even if it's an impossible task, right?
I don't know, man. I think most of them, like if you listen to Charlie Lee or you listen to Fluffy Pony, if you listen to like some of the older altcoiners, none of them have the intention of beating Bitcoin. They just see themselves as like trying to fit some niche, like the privacy niche or like the some tiny little thing that Bitcoin doesn't do very well, and to just like provide that service.
They're improving Bitcoin then. And it's like a pizza. Everybody's got the best pizza shop in every city in the world.
Yeah.
I just finished Digital Gold and then Bitcoin Billionaires before that. And the parts that you talk about Charlie Lee, like, yeah, he tried to make it Litecoin faster. But then I also picked up the rhetoric. I don't know if they said like in text verbatim, but, you know, it was clear to me. Yeah, this is a project that he used to just fucking get more Bitcoin. Like, and in a way, you kind of have to respect him because, again, it goes back to being entrepreneurial or self-interested and just taking advantage of opportunity. But, you know, you can't really, you can only go so far with it until people just look at you like a scumbag. So it's not going to get you that far.
Yeah. I wonder if this experience isn't very common for these altcoin founders. So somebody like founds an altcoin and then like it pumps and then they sell a lot of it for Bitcoin. And this person's like a millionaire now. And then they're like, okay, I got all this $1 million. I sold my coin. So I have all of this value in Bitcoin now. Now I'm going to, and they just like hesitate. They're just like, now I'm going to sell it and pay taxes and buy a house. Like, wait, what am I going to do? I got $1 million worth of value in Bitcoin. And they just like, they're like, what am I going to do? And then they realize, wow, Bitcoin is the best place to keep it. So they just keep it in Bitcoin, right? Because like, if you really understand the space and you really understand Bitcoin and you have $1 million worth of Bitcoin, what are you going to cash out and pay taxes and buy some stocks? Like, that's fucking crazy compared to keeping it in Bitcoin.
It's like the healthy miser. It's like, you know, I'll be honest. I think I might have mentioned it, but like, I've considered like, trying to maybe sell just a little bit, but I don't even have that much. And the longer I hodl, the more it's going to be worth. And it feels precious to me. Like, I know I sound like Gollum right now, but it literally feels like my precious. I don't want to part with my Bitcoin. Now, life is too short. You have to enjoy yourself. But I'm not saying it's not going to hurt if I do sell some, because it's, those specific UTXOs are never coming back to me. And
well, the fact is, even if the next top goes to 300,000, you know, and you sell at 300,000, there will be a point in the future where you don't feel great about selling, you know.
Yeah, and plus you're paying taxes on that 300,000, so it's not 300,000.
And the fuck says you have to pay taxes?
Then what are you going to buy with it?
Can you guys hear
keep
me?
It in cash and keep it in your bank?
Yeah, we got you, Frito.
Yeah, what's up?
So I have a theory about altcoin creators, and that the issue with altcoin creators is they know that they're frauds. They know that they're not a real Satoshi. They know that they're just imitating this amazing idea, and they're not willing to put in the extra effort to like force success. That's why they always cash out. Even Vitalik has like been pushed over and over again to actually try, because he doesn't want to actually try because he doesn't believe in himself. Bad movements can win. Bad movements win all the time, but none of the altcoin creators actually believe in themselves to pass enough to succeed in a major way. If Vitalik is entirely dependent on corporate partnerships to achieve legitimacy, he's coalition building like a political loser that he is, you know? That's not how you get power, just going and getting a bunch of corporations on your side. You just take power. Now, Satoshi just did it. Even the people that succeeded Satoshi have all kind of considered themselves frauds on the inside and have been bad leaders as a result.
Well, not only that, but Vitalik keeps doing it or else he's going to fucking jail.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, I can't remember where I heard this, but think of it and just think of all these projects that are built on top of Ethereum. I mean, can you not imagine the feds you know, looking more into that and trying to blame Vitalik for all these people losing their money, essentially. I wish I remembered where I heard someone talk about this on some podcast, but I think there's a lot on at risk for him on his plate, and just for how many people have gotten burned, whether it's through Ethereum or, you know, whatever dumb crypto project adjacent to it.
I mean, there's no way a project can succeed in the way Bitcoin does if the leader isn't anonymous. And so these altcoin creators have to know that. So either they understand the power of anonymity and they understand why their crypto is never going to get there, or they don't understand the power of anonymity and so their crypto is never going to get there. Like, there's nothing. I was telling somebody this the other day, like, how do you know that no coin's going to replace Bitcoin? It's like, there hasn't even been a coin with an anonymous founder yet. Like, maybe Grin, but not really. I mean,
that's so what I was going to say.
There's been 20, 30, what, 40, 50,000 coins introduced. Not a single one of them has had the most important property of any coin that would succeed Bitcoin, which is the anonymity of the creator. So it's like, it's not that a coin hasn't done it. It's that no coin has even tried. There hasn't been a coin that's even tried to replace
Bitcoin. I think Pepe Cash succeeded. I don't think anybody knows who started it. I think we were so conscious of what we were doing back then that somehow it didn't get out. I think just because of blind luck and the fact that we were trying to do it right.
That's smooth hair, Pepe, man. That one really sold me.
It was a good one.
Shall I listen to Roger Ver on Pomps?
No, I didn't. Did you? Can anyone give us a summary of that one?
You know, I thought it was good.
Really? Give us a summary.
I don't know if I can do it justice. I mean, we kind of all know the story of Roger. I don't know.
Was it contentious or is just like, I saw one clip from it. And Pomp was asking, I didn't actually watch the interview, but I saw the clip, and Pomp is like, how much money did you lose trying to pump Bcash? And Roger's like, I lost a lot of money. It was like, damn, I don't even want to know how much money the guy lost. Crazy.
I think it just goes back to these people are still Bitcoiners and they know it. And he's just been down his own shithole for so long. He's just got to keep at it. And it would be a lot better if he just gave up and came clean, because he's still a radical ANCAP, and it, you know, like I still feel like shit, and like, you know, some might call me a shit coiner for saying this, but I have respect for the dude.
I like
just
him.
Other than him utterly scamming people, and you know, in fact, I responded to something on Twitter. He's like, hop in my DMs and I'll tell you secrets of what Bcash can do that Bitcoin can't. And I just, you know, commented, will it blow me and hold my beer at the same time? You know, because, you know, just saying those, tweeting stuff out like that is just clear honeypotting newbies, because they don't know better. And if you come from the ANCAP side like I did, you know, you would think Roger Ver is the shit. And like, no, you're basically just going to get scammed into buying Bcash like I did. And but other than that, like him just as a businessman and, you know, what he did with his, you know, selling RAM space or whatever, and just his story is cool. And it's just a shame of the, you know, the direction that he went. So I don't really know really what caused that. I guess he was in deep pockets with Bitmain, and I know he was one of the first investors in Bitcoin companies, so maybe he was, a lot of people were breathing down his neck, or maybe he was just greedy. I don't know, but you know, it's a real shame, because I know a lot of people starting out in Bitcoin were big fans. You know, Guy just talked about this when he was on Brady's podcast, and it really is a shame if you're that ideological and to, you know, see someone fall like that, like, yeah, no shit. Learn to kill your heroes sooner than later. Not to say that Roger Ver was ever my hero by any means, but, you know, it's kind of like I'm more sympathetic to his story. And it'd be cool to even like have a conversation with them, but it's just a goddamn shame of, you know, kind of what he did. But if you listen to Pomp's podcast, it's kind of, you know, he wasn't lying about anything by any means.
I think he really believed
it. Like it's not like he came out and said, yeah, Bitcoin Cash is a scam or anything like that. But I don't know. It was just an interesting conversation.
One of the problems in Bitcoin, but this is a problem in all kind of rational thought in general, is in rational thought, there is no redemption and there is no forgiveness. Redemption and forgiveness are Christian ideas that were destroyed by rational thought. So once you mess up, that's it for you forever.
You know? In rational thought, there is no forgiveness and there is no redemption.
Those are not rational things.
Isn't it rational to forgive someone just to get on to get on? Because if you're in, I mean, Steven Tyler did this in Aerosmith. Like years later, he just had to forgive all the shit that he hated his bandmates for. So, you know, they could tour and stuff and be buds. I mean,
there's a common
sense. You can just relate that to any social situation. Like, it's better to just like accept and forget and move on. And, you know, in a way, that's how like markets work. So isn't it essential to forgive and forget?
Yeah, that's common sense. Common sense is not part of rational thought. That's kind of a separate thing. But yeah, rational thought is more like, why would you forgive a computer that breaks, that gives you wrong equations? Once it gives you a wrong result once, why would you ever forgive it? That's how rationalists think.
I'd never forgive a computer that did that. I'd hold a grudge forever.
Yeah, but and then they apply the same thing to human beings. That human beings are just, you know, a series of biological processes similar to a computer. So why would you forgive them once they messed up once? It's irrational. Why would you allow them to redeem themselves? They're just going to betray you again if they betrayed you the first time, like a computer would.
Yeah. Getting back to this like altcoin founders thing, if you listen to OG guys like Charlie Shrem, and you listen to people that knew these guys before they kind of went down their own path, like Roger Ver or Jihan Wu or Vitalik, like at one point in these people's lives, their mind was blown by Bitcoin, and Bitcoin was the only thing they could think about. And they had this group of friends and they talked about how much they loved Bitcoin, and like their life was changed forever. So it's like Bitcoin still has this special place in their heart for any of them. And so it's like, it's weird when we all start hating them because we're all like the same in a way. They just went down a weird path.
On that note, maybe I listened to Eric Voorhees.
Yeah, Eric Voorhees, same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was just on Bankless. It's the one that David Hoffman and some other DeFi dude does, but I don't even know how I found it. I think it was like a recommendation on Spotify or some shit. It was really interesting. At the very end, like, I was solid with them 100% all the way, and he was just describing everything that was wrong with fiat and 100% Bitcoin ideology, sound money, great shit. And then again, I'm not doing this justice, but towards the end he started, you know, hitting on maximalists for, you know, getting all the bad stuff about Ethereum mixed up, you know, with actually Ethereum, because all the, you know, bad projects and everything that happened on Ethereum are centralized and everything. Oh, here's the argument he was trying to make, that Bitcoin could be more centralized than Ethereum. And on Ethereum, you just have all this free market of like projects. And it's like, no, that's just failed money. Bitcoin's the best money because it's literally digital gold and it has the best properties of money, properties that you had mentioned in the first 80% of this episode. So what the fuck? You probably have a lot of deep pockets with the Ethereum projects, and you have your Shapeshift company, which frankly, it sounds cool, but wait, you know, Voorhees, I bet he charges a shit ton for, you know, Bitcoin, maybe has a super big premium like BitPay did or some shit. But I don't, it's just irritating. Like he's well-intended, or he always sounds like it. His ideology is there. It's cool. I'd love to meet that dude too. But, you know, I think a lot of these early Bitcoiners kind of, you know, suffer today, or there's a stigma around them by current Bitcoiners and older Bitcoiners like Dan Held. But a lot of the early dudes, I guess, kind of went down this alt rabbit hole, and the people that came around later that became maximalists, you know, get them shit, and probably for better, because maybe they do shitty altcoin business practices that people didn't like. I don't know.
But like we said, they're not really altcoiners, you know, in their heart. They're, you know, they're just trying to accumulate Bitcoin, you know, like Charlie Lee and Samson Mao, or, you know, the, you guys, I don't know if you guys watch that Magical Crypto YouTube channel, but that's got those guys on there, and they freely admit, you know, they're like the head of these altcoin projects, and yet their opening jingle to their YouTube channel is like, you know, just buy Bitcoin and hold it.
That's awesome.
So it's like,
like, you can't not respect that. Like, it kind of sucks, but the fact that they had the balls to admit that, like, you know, you can't not respect that, because in a way they're being honest, but then they present themselves in a different way, which is completely dishonest. But I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, if you guys don't mind, I kind of want to transition to a topic about people running nodes, if that's cool.
Please, let's do it.
One of the problems I think about a lot is that I think the strength in Bitcoin comes from its decentralization, which comes in large part from people holding their own keys and running their own nodes, because when you run your own node, that's when you kind of can decide which consensus rules to run. And so then you're a part of the governance of the system. But then on the other side of this coin is that, like, well, no pun intended there with coin, but on the other side of this argument is that if people see Bitcoin becoming the backbone of the financial system, like the global settlement layer for countries and corporations and stuff like this, where each Bitcoin transaction is, you know, $100,000 and there's like $100 transaction fees. If this really happens to the main chain, do we still expect the individual people to run nodes in their house? And if not, then does Bitcoin retain the decentralization? I guess I'm saying, like, can Bitcoin retain its decentralization with people running nodes at their house and also become this financial backbone and become like the global settlement layer? You guys see what I'm saying?
Wait, what's stopping them from
being, because, decentralized? Like, okay, if each Bitcoin transaction, I'm not talking about Lightning, I'm talking about the main chain. If each main chain Bitcoin transaction is a $100,000 transaction, and, you know, the transaction fee on it is $100 or whatever, why would individuals want to run a node in their house? They're not going to be sending $100,000 transactions from their house. I mean, I am, but, like, you guys aren't.
Oh, wow.
Damn, no, that sounded bad.
I didn't consider myself that much of a pleb.
Because you guys are... No, you guys are going to sell out and buy houses in a little while. I'm not buying shit.
Nah.
I'm keeping my Bitcoin forever.
So if it got to that extent, and I'm kind of naive on the whole fee market thing, but if fees got that high, then I think there's a problem with the fee market in that there is no fee market. Because if there's a competitive fee market, then... Oh, all right.
I mean, even if fees stay like they are now, just like 50 sats per byte, just like some amount of sats. If 50 sats is worth $10, then I don't know. I guess that gets into what the value of the dollar is. Anyway, what do you guys think about that?
Would that I don't know. Can someone explain, like, how the fees should work? Because I thought the fees would be lower because it would be competitive on the chain, and then it would get more competitive on Lightning, and then people would move to Lightning. So the cost of fees would, like, level out.
I think the thing you can go, Frito.
But I think we need to think about scaling in a different way than traditionally we think about scaling. So when Facebook scales, is going up from the amount of users from like 1 million to 10 million to billions of users. And you just have to keep creating bigger and bigger services. But we don't necessarily, we're not necessarily scaling larger in Bitcoin. The scaling means just like the original concept of one, you know, one processor, everyone's going to mine at one processor, one vote. That's in the original white paper. The idea is that the Bitcoin scales in a way where more people come on the network, but each individual participant can still verify everything individually. So I think the goal of second layer solutions is to enable you to still be able to verify your transaction at the local level, and that, you know, being able to connect to the main chain, have that node, as well as connecting to whatever second layer solution, that you should always be able to have the equivalent of being able to verify everything locally when we scale. That's what I think we mean by scaling. It's not scaling up, it's not scaling down. It's maintaining the one person, everyone's equal on that node level.
Yeah. So Steve, two points that I'll make on that is, one is that the way that you're extrapolating out into the future of, you know, one, the average Bitcoin transaction being $100,000 and then average fees being $100, like maybe that's the case, but maybe it's that but we have a different batching mechanism. You know, when a big exchange batches all their customer fund, you know, customer transactions, like there's a lot of efficiency in doing that. And, you know, with Schnorr and with, you know, other things, there's a lot of potential benefits from, you know, cross input validation and batching that could happen in the future. And I just think that we've got to take into account those types of technical improvements and things that, like, it might be very rare in the future for you as an individual to send, you know, your $500 transaction as its own transaction on the chain. Maybe that's like, you know, your Citadel has a transaction every hour, and you can just batch in with a bunch of people that you know that you can, you know, cross validate signatures and that kind of thing. And from the node aspect of things, like, did anybody see Taj Draja's U3XO stuff recently?
Nope.
So U3XO is, you know, Taj is one of the co-authors of the Lightning Network white paper with Joseph Poon. And this is a new thing for him relating to nodes, which it cuts out, you know, the average, like a full node today, a fully validating node, like 300 gigs or something. But with this U3XO, you're only keeping like a subset of the UTXO set. And like, there's like a, I can't explain technically how it works, but basically you have to keep like, you know, way less than a gig of data to validate the whole UTXO set.
Yeah, doesn't it only take like the headers?
I don't know enough about it to speak technically, but it's like a phenomenal, you know, node, like a more lightweight but validating node. So you would still need people to have the full chain to like to serve to those U3XO nodes, but there's like those types of improvements are just massive for that type of thing, and make it really, really possible for an individual to run their own node and still validate their own transactions.
That wasn't a mobile solution, was it? I think we just have to, like,
I'm sorry, what's that, Bill?
What wasn't, U3XO wasn't a mobile solution, was it?
I think it could be, yeah. Just because the amount of data you need is so small, it's another, you know, lightweight node option.
Right.
So every, you know, all the nodes on the network would not want to be U3XO nodes, but if, you know, a lot of them could be, and they're like a better option than a normal lightweight node.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
It's just because stuff like that that, like, we don't, there's so much innovation and development happening on this stuff. I just think it's kind of ridiculous to have too much legitimate fear about these types of things. I think a lot of them are going to get solved with innovation and time.
Here's another way to think about it. Like, people used to think they weren't going to need the internet. They didn't think they needed an email address. They didn't think they needed a Facebook account. But it adapts to get to everybody. So when you think about scaling, the node system of you verifying all transactions yourself is going to scale to where everybody is doing it. Even though right now it's cumbersome and it doesn't seem like everyone's doing it, it's going to become easy, just like email became easy with Gmail and stuff. It's just going to keep becoming more accessible to the populace until it's ubiquitous. And we haven't seen that breakthrough yet. We haven't seen the explosion in nodes of 10x, 100x increase in nodes. But at some point, there'll be an ease of use breakthrough that will make that very common.
I don't know, man. I mean, I hope so.
People used to have to host their own email servers if they wanted to send emails. That was too much. They said, why would I ever send emails? I'm not going to do that. I might use the internet for some things, but I don't need my own email server. That's too much work.
Right,
and eventually, it just became super easy.
But I think that's kind of a trap because
the solution there was centralization, though.
Exactly.
I mean, so of course you can solve scaling problems through centralizing.
And then you run into a problem where you have to rely on Ledger servers or Electrum servers, whereas you're much safer if you have your own server and, you know, for privacy reasons. I wonder if that changes, though, with Taproot. But then again, I don't see Taproot, like, decentivizing people to run nodes.
But because the internet was a corporate project, it was incentivized to centralize into large monopolies, whereas this project is incentivized the opposite direction. Bitcoin is less valuable when it's centralized, and it's more valuable when it's decentralized. And I think the community's values is going to push it it's not going to push it towards centralization. It's going to keep pushing it further and further, further out.
Yeah. I mean, like, I get that things like U3XO, I don't know the details of that, and like SPV wallets, and like there's things you can do if you're only worried about your wallet. Like, if you're only worried about validating that all of the coins in your wallet have the right Merkle tree headers and you can trace them all back to, you know, their Coinbase, that's fine. But it, you know, downloading the entire blockchain is the only way to, like, totally validate the system. And the entire blockchain is 250 gigs and it's growing at 50 gigs per year, and hard drives just aren't growing that fast. And it's like, we have the world's best computer scientists trying to make this thing as efficient as possible. And so it's like, I mean, I agree that there's going to be things. So,
hey, Steve, one thing, I'm almost positive that U3XO is validating all the transactions.
Really?
So it actually is fully validating. It's just, it doesn't store, you know, the blockchain like a normal validating node does.
Okay.
I'm almost positive of that.
Okay. Maybe that is.
I mean, if you have the header, then you have like the top of the Merkle root, and you know that's good for anything else that's under it. So that kind of makes sense. If I understand how the fuck Merkle trees work.
Yeah. I get you couldn't then be somebody that served out the blockchain to other people, but maybe what you're saying is that
exactly. You know, So
the people that
it's not a good solution for everybody, but some people could use it.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the sense, if Bitcoin goes down, we need enough people that can reboot it if need be.
Yeah. I mean, it's more than that. I mean, we need enough full node operators that, like, no matter what Bitcoin transaction you get, you can validate it back to the very beginning. And also help bootstrap people, new users coming on. I mean, there's going to be new developments. There's going to be all sorts of things that are in the gray area between you know, running a full node and running a SPV wallet. And I guess we just need more and more of those things to come online. But I'm not sure if that really even solves my answer to my question, though. Like, I still wonder if the average Bitcoin transaction is $100,000 and fees are that high. If people, I guess maybe if something really interesting happens with the Schnorr multisig, and it's like when you own Bitcoin, you actually don't even own a full UTXO. Like, you just own some weird Schnorr partial part of a UTXO that you can spend somehow. I don't know. Maybe Schnorr will have something magical in it.
I get what you're saying, man. It's not a 0% worry for me, but I think we have a lot of options.
Yeah.
And that's a good problem to have.
That's true.
I guess.
I just don't think there are any dead ends that we can run into. Like, if we're going to break through every barrier we need to get it to be to the level of every individual just having a fully validating known on whatever common device that they're using all the time. You know, I think if that's the goal, it will be accomplished.
Yeah. All right. Maybe that topic wasn't as interesting as I thought it would be. Hey, Paul, I think you might need to bring something away from the microphone or something like that. All right.
Yeah, Papa, I don't know what's up, dude.
Who's got the next topic?
Oh, I mean, I still think that's interesting, but I think, okay, who's echoing? Going once, going, okay, cool, whatever. No, I think, I get scared thinking about it, but I just hope and believe the incentives are strong enough to have that problem not be a problem. But yeah, if fees were to ever get that high, I don't think people will be using Bitcoin. But if
I think
you got to mute, dude.
So to get back to your original question about the fees. So the minimum fee that you can pay is 1 sat per byte. And the minimum number of bytes of a Bitcoin transaction is like 100. So really, like, the minimum number of sats that you can pay. Actually, I think it's more like 500, isn't it? It's like, anyway, there's a dust limit, which is basically paying 1 sat per byte. And a transaction is a certain number of bytes. So it's like you can't pay 0 sats and get a transaction through. You're going to have to pay some amount of sats, like in the hundreds, for like the minimum possible. So if it happens that like 100 sats is worth $100, then there's nothing that can go lower than that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess it could change.
Except that's not, you know, with Schnorr and Taproot, that's not really a problem if everyone's using Lightning at that point. And I feel like if you're actually settling, then everyone's kind of pitching in to some extent to pay the fee. I guess if you're doing a giant multisig, but I don't know. I don't think it gets to that point. I hope not. And if we're all using Lightning, then it's not really an issue. And that's interesting. I didn't know the sats per byte was to make up for dust, but that makes total sense because the problem with dust is it's not enough to like be used. So the sats are like filling in the spaces that the dust can't fill, if I understand that correctly.
Right, yeah.
That's awesome.
I don't think Lightning really solves the issue that I'm talking about, because if everyone's using Lightning, then definitely no one has an incentive to run a node.
I think we're thinking economically wrong about Bitcoin fees. Like, we need to figure out, which some economists I think could do, what sort of fees in sats are actually possible. Like what the maximum number of fees, if we always keep the blocks at 1 megabyte, if we have, you know, it can't get that high. Like there should be some sort of standardized Satoshis based on the $21 million supply to pay to get into a block. Like it's not ever going to get past a certain point. You're never going to pay, you know, 5 Bitcoins in a Bitcoin fee, you know, just to get included, I don't think. Like there has to be an upper limit. But when we think in dollars, we're going to get all confused. But we have to think about what's the maximum number of sats we could ever pay as a Bitcoin fee.
Yeah, I do think that's the right way to look at it. Because you look historically and people, I don't know if it's a true statement for all of time, but yeah, there were people paying really huge fees measured in today's dollars back when the chain was not busy or crowded at all, you know?
Yeah, I suspect the number is going to be 50 Bitcoin divided by how many, you know, 3 to 4 transactions per second times 10 minutes. Like that's the most you could ever be. I don't think we'll ever surpass that number percentage for a fee.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to understand that fees are paid as a function of the memory that it's used for the transaction to fit in. It's not like a function of the total worth of the transaction.
But do you think the fees would ever exceed 50 Bitcoins in a single block?
I mean, so...
Like, I think that's just a good base because that was the initial block reward, I believe. So how could we ever get back to paying more than that?
So it would be, I mean, fees are really nicely a market, right? So miners are always going to put the transaction that has the biggest fee as the first thing in their list. So it's not like we can make a cap on that kind of thing. Because I can always write a computer program to send a Bitcoin transaction with a huge fee, and a miner can always put it in their block. Like it's
so
that's not the kind
so
of
maybe
thing.
Sorry.
No, I was just gonna say that's not the kind of thing that there's like a central authority that's going to like lay that rule down. You know, it's a free market in fees for the miners.
Yeah, I do think it might be an interesting way to look at that question to say, if we ever see fees of more than 50 Bitcoin per block, maybe something is messed up in mining to where some miner that has, you know, 45% of the hash rate knows they're going to get 45% of the block. So they don't mind overpaying because they're going to get most of that back. But the amount other people are overpaying makes it profitable for them. So that could be like an interesting check on Bitcoin's health if fees were ever too high and they seem higher than they should be.
Oh, you think that might be a sign of miner centralization if we saw that?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good sign of collusion. I don't know if they actually expected the fees to make up for every block reward cut so that once we went from 50 to 25, we'd have 25 Bitcoin's worth of fees in every block. I don't think that was ever really an idea that's been thrown around seriously or even discussed. So I think that, you know, the idea has always been that the amount of actual Bitcoin per block sent to compensate miners should go down over time. And as a result, the value of Bitcoins will be going up over time. So you don't have to pay them the same amount of Bitcoin to do work.
Yeah, I think that's the idea. And I think that is how it's going to play out. I think miners are going to get less and less revenue in terms of Bitcoin, but that revenue is going to be worth more and more in terms of fiat money and, you know, in terms of paying their power bill and stuff.
It really is the beauty of having a deflationary asset, because we kind of see it as we see it now with block reward getting cut in half, but then it gained worth more. And then you can spin that around in actually living in a Bitcoin world where there is just a straight up fixed cap where each Satoshi is worth a dollar or, you know, whatever parity you want. So yeah, like as we all kind of expected, you know, the miners will get rewarded less, but then the value of what they do get rewarded is going to increase over time. So yeah, I guess what Steve said, but yeah, I don't think it's anything to worry about. And sort of this whole time I've been listening to this conversation, I got my inner Hayek in the back of my mind, like, dude, don't fucking worry about it. Like, you're a human. You don't have enough knowledge to figure this shit out. I mean, there's a fixed supply and there's other things that we can pontificate over. But at the end of the day, markets are going to market. Like, don't fucking worry about it. You got sound money. Be satisfied with that. And it's going to work out.
Yeah.
Imagine a 50 Bitcoin block in the year 2030. How much Bitcoin is worth in 2030. And every 10 minutes, the miners are mining 50 Bitcoins because of the fees. Like, when you say that number is so astronomical. Like, it's like every 10 minutes they're getting maybe 100,000 people's worth of yearly salaries in each block. So the number has to go down. It'll never get that bad in Satoshis again.
But it also has to do with the demand for getting into a block. Like, I don't think you guys are imagining Bitcoin becoming the backbone that I'm imagining it becoming. Like, if Bitcoin becomes like the Swift network or the Visa network, not in terms of like all these mini transactions, but just in terms of like
settlement, its main functionality, settling.
If it's the global settlement layer and there are millions of people or millions of companies and countries trying to get $1 million worth of money into each block, then yeah, I mean, 50, it might be that it's worth it for them to pay fees of up to 50 Bitcoin per block, because each block might have, you know, a million Bitcoin in them.
I mean, to bring it back to like traditional banking, like, it's not uncommon for a bank to charge, you know, between $15 and $35 for a single wire transfer, you know, and it doesn't cost the bank that much to do the wire transfer.
I think it's what people cost them pay for.
I think it cost them like a quarter to actually access the Fedwire system and send it, but they charge their users, you know, call it $20 per wire. Like, that's a lot of money, you know. If every Bitcoin transaction was $20, you know, you'd be thinking about how often you use the chain.
I think we're going to have a fee cartel, a fee aggregating cartel, and a mining cartel, and they'll compete with each other in the market. So that if the miners start overcharging, the fee cartel will figure out how to stack their transactions in a way so as to not raise prices.
If you have a fee cartel, I don't see how you don't have a 51% attack.
I mean, a cartel is just coordinating. Like, does Saudi Arabia and Iran coordinate well with the oil prices? Not really, but they coordinate well enough to work. You know, it's, if you just kind of post on Twitter, hey guys, the fees are getting too high, let's not all compete for the next block. Let's figure out a smarter system so that we can find some empty space and lower the transaction pressure. That's the sort of coordination you'll see between fee aggregators on the second layer solutions.
I don't think the way Bitcoin runs would let that happen. I think it would get to the extent where fees are too high that even like rich people might turn heads and go, what the fuck is this? And also, I don't think, I don't know. I just don't think the protocol would allow that as far as difficulty or, I don't know.
I personally can't get into it, but I don't think how
it would work.
The way I see it working is there will be, I mean, that's what exchanges are today, is, you know, they're fee aggregators, they're fee cartels, because you could do, you know, not just on-chain fees, but trading fees and wire fees and all these other fees that you experience when you trade Bitcoin with people. Like, you know, that's why firms arise, is to negate transaction costs. Like, that's the Coase theorem. Is
kind of like batching cartels.
Didn't something like this almost happen when we went to, or considering SegWits with that New York agreement with a bunch of miners went to New York to try to enter into some kind of contract to shift the market away from SegWit? I mean, we've seen this kind of conspiracy and backdoor dealing. It didn't work out, but they definitely tried. Yeah. They carried a lot of influence.
Yeah, but the way that we're talking about it is for a positive influence, like to lower your fees.
Oh, I thought Papa Frieda was trying to like scare fuck us.
No. He would never do that. Come on.
I mean, if you like it, but.
No, but I mean, that's what I think will happen is people will opt for slightly, okay, yeah, maybe you can still run a node, but like you can validate your transaction locally, but you're not sending it locally. Like you're sending it through, you know, some third party or some banking app or some exchange or second layer solution or side chain or state chain or whatever. Yeah.
Batching makes it cheaper. So that's a positive. But when it comes to minor cartels, were those in our favor of the scenario we were just describing? I think I misunderstood that.
The minor cartel is not, but the fee batching cartel is.
So the fee batching cartel of the exchanges is countering the mining cartel. Is that what you're saying? To prevent, or not to prevent the high fees, but that's the solution for when there's high fees, is to just have a batching cartel to fight against the minor fee cartel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
another way to think about it is the on-chain transactions are a commodity product just based around space, whereas second layer solutions are not commodity products. They can, whatever your second layer solution, you can have whatever features, you can distinguish yourself from the other second layer solutions. And maybe you don't settle as often as others, or maybe you do settle more often than everybody else. Or maybe you're not just doing Bitcoin financial transactions, you're doing other stuff on your second layer solution. But it really allows for creativity in how these second layer solutions actually create a market for their product.
So I got to ask y'all real quick. Taproot, of course, creates more space for the blockchain, and that makes every, you know, transaction fee cheaper and more private. But right now we're talking about fees and price. So it's going to make settling fees cheaper, which and I guess we established that the miners, of course, want a limited amount of space, and the less space, the better for them because they can charge more in fees. But isn't what happens with Taproot and user-activated soft forks, if that's going to make the customers happier, then shouldn't that make the miners happier? Because if the users of the network are having a better user experience, then isn't that more profitable for the miners at the end of the day? It's almost kind of like a business owner and a customer relationship.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, if like the reason why Taproot is popular with users is because it's good for users of Bitcoin. Right. And miners, you'd think, would want more users of Bitcoin. So
yeah, like it's the same notion of like free open source software, because the more stuff that you put out there, the more people like build and come to market, and they make money and people have better products at a lower price. The same notion should kind of apply to mining. And, you know, and to that extent, I don't see why there aren't more miners like Marty Bent that are super for Taproot and all this shit to really convince other miners that they should be in it too, you know?
Well, and I think that's a big reason why this activation stuff is picking up so much and looking for an alternative to miner signaling, because, you know, a miner like Marty, he's probably going to be for it because he's a user of Bitcoin and he likes Bitcoin. But there are other miners who have you know, opposing views and motivations. And that's why it shouldn't be up to them if it gets activated.
I don't see how they're not in the minority, though, unless they just have so much clout and power.
I don't know. Maybe you own a power company. You don't give a shit about Bitcoin. You just want your power company to make more money.
So I think you guys, the way I see incentives in Bitcoin is completely different. And I don't think it's healthy when we talk about, like, hey, we need to convince the miners to do something. Like, miners are like the people in America that you tell them, you know, it's like you don't tell people that they have to show you that they're not racist or something. It's like, look, these people have their own minds. They have their own desires. You have absolutely no influence over them. You can't tell them what they should do. You can't tell them what they need to do, what they need to do to be popular, what they need to do to help the network, whether they're being a good person or a bad person. Like, you can't approach a miner with any of this kind of bullshit attitude of like trying to shame them for not upgrading or something. Like, if it does not make logical sense for them to upgrade based on their own personal desires, then they shouldn't upgrade. And if Bitcoin can't work with that, then Bitcoin won't work. But like, if we're in a position where we have to shame people into upgrading and like that's what we hope is going to work, like that's just not cool in my opinion. Like,
I'm not saying that we need to shame miners into Taproot, but yeah, it goes back to what you said about it being logical. Like, Taproot's logical for anyone.
Right. So you think if a miner doesn't upgrade to Taproot, that's fine. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, but I'm also saying it's illogical. Well,
you don't know that.
From what I'm, the more I learn about,
you don't know their position. Like, you don't, but you don't know their personal position. You don't know what side of the bed they woke up on today. You don't know if they want to kill themselves tomorrow. You don't know if they prefer suicide. Like, you can't say that it's illogical for them to want something because you don't know.
No, yeah, you're totally right.
It's illogical for you. That's what I'm saying. It's like, we can't come across with this attitude like we know what's logical for miners. We don't.
I'm like searching to hear miners that are against Taproot is my thing.
But they don't have any incentive to talk to you, and they shouldn't. They shouldn't have to explain.
But here's the thing. This is still a conversation. This is still, like, there still has to be society on top of it, which means that you talk about changing things, you inform about differences with and like new tools that are at our disposal. And while there's always risk to changing software, you're also what makes Bitcoin isn't the fact that everybody chooses to run a software. It's a factor involved in defining Bitcoin. But at the end of the day, this is the fact that there is a network with a set of consensus rules that are independent of the actual code, that are independent of which client you're running, and independent of Taproot. Like, Taproot doesn't go against those consensus rules. They are within the consensus rules. So the point of bringing it up to miners and trying to get miners on board with it is that it is less risk. You're asking for a favor. You're saying, will you mine and validate Taproot signatures? Because I want to use them. And unless most miners aren't checking those within the current set of rules, then it's a huge risk for me to use them. But at the end of the day, that is what's going on. And there's never going to be a time where things aren't changing. Maybe there'll be an ossified code, but I still don't think it will mean that we're not using it in a different way or modifying the best way or the most efficient way to use it. And at the end of the day, it's still an economy. Like, it's still a market. The idea is that there is a base set of rules which we are always resorting to when there is a disagreement. That doesn't mean that there should be one just because that's the fallback, just because that's the, it's like, you know, the
a central bank or whatever, the lender of last resort. I mean, this is a bad example because I think they shouldn't exist, but they're the lender of last resort. Well, that doesn't mean that every loan should be from the Federal Reserve or the central bank. It means that they're the ones that are falling into when the Keynesian system goes to shit. And in that same way, we've decentralized that. We've taken the central bank out of the scenario and said the consensus rules are the final arbiter. So I don't think it changes. We should still be having a conversation about it. We should still be reaching out to miners and saying, this is a benefit. There are a lot of people who want to use this. Like, it would be a higher risk for anyone to use this if you aren't verifying. There's a great benefit to upgrading. Upgrade if you want to, but it's not a question of force. It's just an appeal to get everybody on the same page because there's less risk when we do that.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. I'm totally on board with all that. I just get the sense that the miners probably understand this shit 1,000 times better than anyone on this call. And like us talking about like, oh, they need to do this. They need to see how good it is. They're just probably like, you haven't studied this nearly as much as I have. And so it's like there's this mob of people trying to like inform miners about something that they probably know a lot better than we do.
You know, I disagree. You know? That was actually a big part of the problem. There are a lot of miners out there that just see this as a, like, this is a numbers game for them. And they don't like review code, or they're not software engineers. I mean, look at what like Layer 1 and Upstream Capital and stuff are doing, is that the miners are energy producers. Those people don't know shit about
Bitcoin's the protocol. Battery. I mean,
undoubtedly there are some miners who are involved, but I actually think there's a large part of them. They're just like, I used to run a storage facility and sell my space to AWS or whatever the hell. And now we're going to switch it up and we're going to do ASIC miners. These are the best hardware. I think actually there was a great piece that I read, 200 episodes ago or something on the show that was actually talking about this very thing. Is that one of the biggest problems with SegWit and the upgrade was that the mindset between the hardware people and the software people was like huge. Like we think of them as if they're kind of in this same pool, and there's like very little mechanisms for communication between them. They're rarely on the same page. The hardware people aren't keeping up with it at all. They're literally just plugging in computers and printing money. So I actually think the majority of it is the opposite. I mean, there's certainly that element to some miners, but a lot of them are just, they're running a machine that is profitable.
Yeah,
but they're figuring out how to do it.
But the person that's constructing the block header are the people that matter. You know, if someone's just running their machines and they just receive the block header from the pool and they're just hashing it out, that's one thing. But I'm talking about the person that's constructing the block header and sending it out. This is the person that has to upgrade their node. And this person understands.
If you're talking about like a pool operator?
So yeah, the pool operator is the person who has to upgrade their node. None of the individual miners have to upgrade their node. The pool operator is the only person that has to upgrade it. And the pool operator understands the protocol very well. That's the only person that matters about upgrading their node, the pool operator, not the individual miners.
Well, yeah, but so what I want to do is try to come up like a Venn diagram of pros and cons. We'll really focus on the pros of why miners will benefit from Taproot.
Holy shit.
Because,
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I think I prepared my drive.
You what?
That drive that I said I lost earlier. Holy shit, it's back. Oh my God. Okay.
You mean the drive with the secret thing that you couldn't recover?
The secret thing?
Or a different drive.
Thing, but yeah, I thought I lost the drive earlier. I booted in the command line without the operating system, and my file system check worked. It took like 2 hours.
but holy crap, I've got it. All right, I got to copy everything over, like, right this minute. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, Bill.
Oh, no. That was important. Glad he found it. Anyway, fuck. Like, just what are the main pros of Taproot that miners would benefit from? Because I imagine that, I don't know if they pay for their electricity in Bitcoin, but I don't know. I can only imagine that they make a few giant payments in Bitcoin, and Taproot's just going to make that cheaper and more efficient for them. I'm just trying to come up with as many like pros for miners with this shit.
I don't think miners pay for their energy, for their electricity in Bitcoin.
Well, Bitcoin goes up in price. Don't they pay for something in Bitcoin?
No.
So, okay, miners, if there are a lot of people that use the new format of transactions, then that just means that there's going to be a lot of transactions that have this new format. And a lot of transactions means more transaction fees for miners. So the incentive to miners is always just to get more transaction fees. Then more transaction fees will arise because the new format will be popular to users. That's it. Like, I guess Bill walked away after asking that question. Oh, bring back in-person meetups.
Yeah, I agree with you though, man. A lot of people are going to have different feelings on this stuff. And guess what? You can't tell anybody what to do in Bitcoin.
Yeah, you can't tell anybody what to do in Bitcoin. You can't even tell anybody what they should do, because you don't know their situation. It's like, if we're like relying on these upgrades, like I just have like PTSD when it comes to people resorting to politics to try to get things done. But it's like the moment that Bitcoin has to resort to politics in order to like get things accomplished is the moment it just seems like it's failed to me.
Well, and it also, it does make me a little nervous that I really haven't heard any substantive argument against Schnorr and Taproot. And that kind of does make me a little nervous, because whether those claims are well-founded or commonly held, like, it is good to have people challenge you on things, because you take it more seriously when you have to really make a stand on something. So, you know, we're more likely to catch that crazy bug that would have slipped through, or that incentive structure that needed to be different if there's a challenge on it. So it makes me nervous that there's not really much challenge that I've seen.
Yeah, that's why I keep wanting to like dig for it. By the way, Steve, I could hear you. I have my Bluetooth on, but I'm sorry if it looked like an asshole thing to just walk away from you while you were talking.
Oh, no,
we were in person. I definitely would never do that to you, because I respect you as a human.
No big deal.
Cool.
All right.
So Bitcoin is an anarchist capitalist project, right? Anarcho-capitalism. So what does that actually mean? Nobody thinks about it. We just say the word. It means that the Bitcoin miners are anarchist workers. The Bitcoin hodlers are anarchist shareholders. There's no one is ruling the other one. They're both in a state of anarchy. But it's the fact that they're able to work together that the value of the system works. That's the experiment we're running. It's an anarcho-capitalist system. If you have anarchist workers and anarchist shareholders, is that a sustainable system? And there's always this animosity between workers and shareholders under state capitalism, and probably under any form of capitalism. But in state capitalism, the shareholders can tell the workers what to do. In anarcho-capitalism, the two sides are equal. Nobody's ruling over the other one. They have these shared, there's no rulers, there are rules, that's the protocol. But can this actually succeed? Is this experiment going to work out? And we see that reflected in the price of, is it working out or not?
Yeah, that's the beauty of this whole thing, is that there wasn't a guarantee that it was going to get to where it is now. And it was made both from fear and greed, but also from this beautiful place of altruism, through whoever Satoshi was, and you know, he this was a gamble of whoever made this thing, and just to see it progress to where it is now, it's almost kind of silly for it's healthy for us to hash these issues out and have these conversations, but it's also kind of silly to fret about it. But at the same time, that fret and the chaos is synonymous with the Talebian chaos, not just the boom and bust of the Bitcoin market, but the chaos and the back and forth between humans trying to solve problems. And over time, I think that we've seen that that's what's kept Bitcoin successful. So I don't know. I'm torn because, you know, we're bitching about this, but it's also healthy we're bitching about this. And Bitcoin just doesn't give a fuck, and it's just going to keep going. And I don't know. It's like we have the answers, but we don't have the answers. But eventually we get the answer.
I'm 100% on Steve's side in this, in that the miners, they're the best workers. They've yeah. won in the free market. We are not better at Bitcoin than the miners. They outwork us every day, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. They're the best workers. They're not the best protocol people. They're the best workers definitively. That's the proof of work system. There's no doubt that the people that mine Bitcoin are better at mining Bitcoin than people not mining Bitcoin. They've proven that they're the best.
I agree.
The hodlers are in a precarious position in that we have to somehow make the price go up, or we need to figure out a way to acquire more Bitcoin. Like, those are our two basic ways that we succeed at our game. The way they succeed at their game is just by winning the proof of work battle. Somehow hodlers have to either acquire more Bitcoin or make the values of Bitcoin go up in relative goods. But we should never get angry at the miners, and because they are the best workers. Is a hodler a great hodler? I've never met a great hodler in my life. I've only met weak hands that lie about being strong hands.
And now you're not talking about this meetup.
I was about to say, where have you been? You can just get out.
You've all bought shitcoins. You're all bad hodlers. The compared miners, miners kick ass every single day because they're the best workers. They have to prove it every single day. And the idea that the anarchist shareholders can fire the anarchist workers and keep going is kind of one of the craziest ideas in Bitcoin. That the idea that we'll switch proof of work and just fire our workers and somehow that will work. It's one of the dumbest ideas out there. It's almost certain failure at that point.
Oh, to switch proof of work? That's a terrible idea.
That's the nuclear option.
Yeah. No, that's not even, I guess you could call it a nuclear option, because a nuclear option is inherently a bad option. But yeah, I think that's a total destruction of the security of the protocol when the dominance of the market is the ability to pay the workers. So, like, that's why SegWit worked, is because they were threatening the fact that they weren't going to be able to sell their token on the, if they changed the rules, they weren't going to be able to sell their token on the exchange. They were going to be able to sell it in the market because they didn't have a market for it. If everyone is actually running a node, if everybody's running a full node and rejects the modification to the rules, well, then they can, 99% of the miners can go off and change the rules to something else, but there's not a single exchange that will accept that transaction, because the businesses, the services, the users are all going to run nodes. And even if they do get one exchange on board, all those users are going to try to withdraw, and they're not going to be able to withdraw it to their wallet. And they're going to be like, what the hell? Give me my Bitcoin. And it's like, no, we got a shitcoin token now, but we're just calling it Bitcoin. Like, it'd be a freaking disaster. I remember I was having an argument with a guy on Twitter about this, because he kept saying, like, no, miners decide the rules. What are you going to do with a coin that doesn't mine, or with a network that doesn't mine? It's like, well, just wait. Doesn't cost us anything to wait. Costs them bukus of money to burn through millions every 10 minutes just to create a shitcoin that they can't do anything with. And I said, so let's make a thought experiment. I said, you own all the miners and I own all the non-mining full nodes, all the services, all the businesses, all the users or whatever. And it was funny. We ended up going down this road and we got to that point where I was like, all right, well, what are you going to do with your token? You can't sell it. You're burning through. It costs you $1 million every 10 minutes to keep running. What are you going to do? And he was like, well, they wouldn't do that. And I was like, no, we just create, you can't just abandon the thought experiment. I own the nodes. What are you going to do?
Yeah, I agree with that. I hope that that's how it plays out healthy when it's just like obvious financial incentive for them to upgrade. That's how it plays out.
And that validates the whole game theory of Bitcoin. Yeah. You can't piss off the miners because you fuck Bitcoin. And you can't piss off the people that run nodes because you fuck Bitcoin. Everyone's incentivized for the same thing. Keep the whole process hunky-dory so we can all have safe, sound money.
Yeah.
I mean, it plays out perfectly. The beauty of
the incentive system is that everyone is essentially forced to play along. And if there's a disagreement, if there's a disagreement that's hard enough, then nothing happens. The default is no change, always.
Yeah.
Yeah, the awkward thing about Bitcoin is you have the anarchist shareholders hodling, you have the anarchist workers that just work hard and try to make money. And in between, just like in every society since the 1800s, is the anarchist intelligentsia. And everyone hates the anarchist intelligentsia. This is why, this is the people, you know, who I was talking about, who we never forgive, we never allow them to redeem themselves. Because these are the people in between that are trying to make this relationship work and possibly change this relationship over time. And that pisses everybody off. Is it's just, we don't want to give up the, but these people hold the culture in their hands. They're the developers. This is kind of why people want to just ossify the protocol so that we can stop making, so no one is in between the miners and the hodlers, because we don't like, this intelligentsia has seemingly no economic incentives to do anything. They just have basically spiritual and political incentives to do the right thing, but they have so much potentially dangerous power. They can't do that much good, honestly, but they could bring it down pretty bad with a, you know, with a bad update, you know.
Yeah. But they're not incentivized to pass a bad update.
But no
one, and plus, like, passing that update in the first place relies on our consensus.
But that's the advantage of an ossified protocol, is there's no incentive for them to mess things up intentionally. But if they want to just preserve their position as the gatekeepers between these two groups, the workers and the shareholders, that they can keep doing upgrades. And one of those upgrades that was supposed to be good wasn't properly done and it could mess things up. You know, this is the advantage of just really at some point clamping down and saying no more upgrades.
Yeah, I hope for an ossified consensus at some point in the future. One thing that also kind of stumped, like, my mind goes to, and that's partly PTSD from living in this country, is that I see a lot of people that just virtue signal all the time when secretly they absolutely don't agree with something, but they know that the mob wants them to signal that they agree. And like, I worry, maybe I shouldn't worry about this, but something in the back of my mind sees this scenario where the pool operators are like, oh yeah, they want us to signal, so let's just give them what they want. And then like, they play this huge joke on us where they just fake signal the entire time, just to kind of prove to us that like, they are the ones in control. It's like, they actually liked Taproot. They just hated the mob that was forcing them to signal. So they just did this, just this fake signaling, just to like—
Great troll.
Just to troll us, just to show them that like, our interests don't matter, you know, like that would be hilarious just to troll us. And then they actually did activate together when they wanted to, you know, like that would be hilarious.
Oh my gosh.
I would classify the pool operators as part of the intelligentsia, the protocol developers as part of the intelligentsia, and the exchanges as part of the intelligentsia. Because all three of those people aren't really necessary, but they've made themselves necessary, which is what intelligentsia does.
Mm.
That we could all exist without them, but there's not that much of a push to, oh, we actually have to get off the exchanges. We actually have to stop using centralized exchanges. There's not enough push for that. There's not enough push, emotional push, to get to stop developing the protocol pretty soon completely and get everything on other layer solutions. And there's not much, what was the last one? There's not much of a push to get rid of pools because they've been useful for the miners, despite their drawbacks.
There's always going to be pools.
Yeah. Well, I think the pool problem is, can actually be mitigated with better hash. And Stratum version
That's true. Yeah. It
actually inherits that. And I think two major pools have already switched over to that, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, because open source too, right?
Open source and just available. I think it's just kind of a push that hasn't felt necessary, just because the pools are actually pretty distributed right now, at least as far as, you know, Bitcoin's history has gone. It's like, you know, 15-20% by a handful of pools, and then it starts to break up into smaller bit batches. So I don't think there's any like huge risk right now of like, oh my God, centralization and miners are controlling everything, and haven't had a SegWit since 2017 of that sort of a problem. So there's just no pressure for it, but that's already there and basically ready to go. So that at least I think is a problem that can and will be mitigated just kind of with time.
Let me read you the definition of intelligentsia, because I just found this definition today, and it really helps you understand the people in Bitcoin that are actually this. Intelligentsia is a class of educated people engaged in the complex mental labors that critique, guide, and lead in shaping the cultures and politics of their society.
Oh, the experts.
The experts. That we need to get past experts in Bitcoin. You know, we don't want to, as long as they're around, it's kind of a dangerous, it's an unwieldy system.
We don't have Bitcoin experts. We have crypto experts, but I don't.
Oh, God.
I don't think that.
Which is worse.
But they're the same, man. I don't even know.
Well, and that's my point. I mean, who can you name that you would think is a Bitcoin expert? And again, I've barely been in this shit for a year, so I could be totally fucking wrong. But who identifies themselves as like an open Bitcoin expert or
expert?
Guy's a Bitcoin expert. I'd say I was a Bitcoin expert.
Well, we know that.
I would agree with
Guy's
that.
Guy's a Fed.
I use Steve as a resource.
Hey, not trying to avert the expert question, but I just wanted to say this before we leave this topic. Has anyone thought about a way, in order to avoid the fake signaling thing, that the miners would have to hash the version of the code that they're running? Like, you know how you can do a checksum of some software that you download so that you know that every bit is right? Like, is there any way that...
You could commit to it in the op return, I think.
Yeah, like, some way that, like, we didn't have to guess that the miner actually has this activation software when really they just modified their code and are doing a fake signaling. Is there any way that we can prove that they have this version of the software in there?
It's like they would have to run the software
and hash
and then
itself.
Hash that to hash itself, which includes the hash.
Which includes the latest transactions.
I don't think there's a trustless way really to do that, because technically on their computer, they could always modify their client to just hash the install file that they've got sitting in a different folder that they're not even running, and then, you know, commit to that. But just that alone, having to do that, would at least let you know that they downloaded the software. They had the software on file to hash in, like, specifically, which means that basically at that point, well, they fuck themselves, they fuck themselves, you know, like okay, like you could install it, you could be running it if you're really going to go out of your way not to. Well, yeah. Then they've pushed all of this to happen and incentivized it and signaled it and made it appear as if everybody was ready if they're not ready. And then they end up burning a bunch of wasted blocks. That's not really anybody else's problem at that point.
Hey, Deez, yeah. I got to bounce. It was great chatting.
All right. See you, man.
Yo.
Adios. Later, man.
Yes. So you could do a hash of the block header together with the latest software version so that the hash would be different every time, but everyone could verify that you,
that you had the software.
Cool operator that operates dishonestly will like lose his business. Like that's the incentive mechanism that should handle it. The real thing that you want to look out for someone who's falsely signaling is someone who never admits they're falsely signaling. So they'll publicly advocate for something, but never do it. And this is the personal way to advocate, to understand someone who's lying to you, is that they say they want something, but they disagree with your timetable and they disagree with your method. If they do one of those two things, they're lying about agreeing with you. They say, oh, we can't do it that fast. We need a different threshold. It shouldn't be implemented this way. Those people are the false signalers. And they're never going to take the official action to expose themselves as the false signaler and actually put it in a way that's accountable. But they'll always claim to be on your side.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Everyone who's about Black Lives Matter is lying. That's what I'm getting at.
Okay.
Every single one of them. None of them want to abolish the prisons. None of them want to defund the police. Because when it actually comes forward, they're going to claim, oh, this isn't the bill I was talking about. This is too fast. This is missing things that I expect to be in this bill. They're all liars.
I don't understand. I mean, I don't understand. It's not even close to out of the ordinary for this day and age. So I guess it's super easy to understand. But that the same people I hear say, like, we should have gun control, have now gone to defund the police. And I'm like, how do you think you enforce gun control? Like, how are you going to, are social workers, are weaponless social workers going to enforce gun control? It's like, what do you, like, do you want a state, a police state? Because that's what gun control means. Or do you not? Because that's what defund the police means. But those are literally two separate things.
You know, gun control means don't let black people have guns. Because black people live in cities. Let's make sure cities can't have guns. That's it's very simple. White collar crime means, or white collar prisons means white people prisons. Like, the country is not as complex as it appears.
I went to a gun show this past weekend and the line to get in there was like an hour long. And I saw this one guy wearing a t-shirt. It was great. It said defund the media.
That's a winner.
The media is such a scam. Like, if you look at their ratings, it's clear they're just having money funneled into them to like prop up this losing product that nobody wants. Nobody watches CNN, yet at the same time, Raytheon's going to give them free money, and Raytheon's getting their money from the federal government. Like, it's obvious what's happening. we're just getting this propaganda paid for by the military buying commercials.
It is strange to think that someone like Joe Rogan has more viewers than, you know, any of these big media outlets. And these big media outlets have, you know, hundreds of thousands of employees. And Joe Rogan has 4. Yeah, I mean, it's like, are they just killing it? Like, how does that work?
Oh, it's just new medium, new, think about the reach.
Think about honesty, man.
Like, it's honesty. It's honesty. Yeah. It's a new platform. It's a new type of media. And people are desperate for authenticity. That is why YouTube blew up. And everything on the news is the exact opposite of that. And after you find yourself in this digital age, you start to crave authenticity, even the most extreme, ridiculous authenticity. If you if you think that that's a real person, you're like, I got to watch this thing. This is crazy. And I love the birth of the long form, like audio format, that you can have a 2 hour conversation and dive into something, the details, rather than a 5 minute blurb of two dumbasses screaming at each other on CNN before you get 6 minutes of commercial. Like, it's such a horrible format for actually informing anybody of anything. And because of that, it's just a whole different audience. But not only that, it's a different reach. Joe Rogan, anybody in the world can connect to the internet and listen to Joe Rogan. You got to have cable TV to watch CNN the U.S.
Dude, you got to have Spotify to listen to Joe.
We're bringing those walled gardens back. That's right. That's right.
They're about to take out Joe Rogan. It's a planned hit. They've taken out Chris D'Elia. They've taken out Brian Callen. They keep getting closer to Joe. It's funny watching them try to get him involved. This whole contract was kind of a way to buy him out. I don't know if it's going to succeed or not, but it's very interesting what's happening there. Like, they do not want Joe Rogan to be.
I heard from Joe Rogan personally. He's just going to market buy Bitcoin with that $100 million.
Nice. I still listen to him on YouTube. Is he not allowed to be on YouTube anymore?
Well, not after the end of the year.
Oh, really? Okay.
Is it straight up exclusive Spotify? It won't even be on YouTube? Because I thought he was still going to do the video format. He just wouldn't. His RSS feed was going to be exclusive to Spotify. I mean, I could be wrong. That was the impression that I got, but I didn't dig much
into it. I got the impression that they were going to, like, take all his shit and put it on Spotify.
Wow.
Yeah, my impression is Spotify is going to become a direct YouTube competitor. They're going to start doing videos. Gotcha. They're going to be the non-censored version of YouTube, or at least try to pretend to be the non-censored version of YouTube.
If they put all of Joe Rogan's content, like, up there, then yeah, they really need to do a YouTube thing, because a shit ton of people watch Joe Tube. Like, they watch Joe him on Tube. Video.
Any podcast.
In fact, that's where I mostly will listen to. I'll put his shit on in the living room while I'm, like, working on stuff or doing dishes or whatever.
It's about time he left, because that show used to have clips every episode, hilarious clips, or just be able to pull up things and show it. And once YouTube stopped censoring that, that's when he should have left. Once you start getting censored, it's time to go immediately. You just got to start making plans. Even the smallest censorship, it's never going to stop.
It's just a steamroll. Like, there's nowhere to go but one direction.
Hey, Guy, are you getting ready for some debate you were talking about, or do you already have it?
Yeah. No, that's tomorrow night. I've not really.
You need us to prep you for it?
Yeah. I guess so.
Yeah. I'm debating with Johnny Litecoin. He made some ridiculous tweet video thing about how it doesn't make any sense to only accept one payment method. Like, when you go to a store or whatever, they don't accept only Visa. They accept Visa, they accept MasterCard, they accept cash, they accept blah, blah.
Those are all the same thing.
I want to point out Lightning Network is the same thing. You have Bitcoin, you can use Lightning Network.
That is not a currency, that is a payment method. But he thinks that this is analogous to accepting Litecoin and Ethereum Classic and Bitcoin Cash, and that it's idiotic to think that there's only going to be one, that Bitcoin is going to be dominant, and that the worst thing that ever happened to Bitcoin was, you know, keeping the block size small. And it thinks it's a terrible, terrible. It's all, I mean, he owns like a thing that's just Litecoin point of sale. It's all about merchant adoption, like 100%. If it's not merchant adoption, wow, then you're just an idiot and a tool who's bought into the gold narrative or whatever. And he on his stuff, it says, we actually use cryptocurrency, unlike Bitcoiners and shit. So, yeah.
That's going to be easy pickings.
I really should prepare, yeah, but I'm, and maybe it's a bad thing that I'm not worried about it. Because I should be prepared for, like, you know, a kind of unexpected argument or something like that, but.
It's crazy to think that it was 4 years ago when I got into those debates. Like that was a 2016 debate. Man.
Yep.
Well, there's no example of any civilization in history using two coins, two different currencies at the same time that aren't pegged, is there? Like you can have
were gold and silver pegged while they were transactional in the US?
I assume the actual coinage, once you got minted them, that those were standard ratios. That the ratio of a silver coin with the Roman person's face on it and a gold coin were not going to fluctuate from on a day-to-day, month-to-month basis.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know,
I don't know. It's extremely rare one way or the other.
That's one of the problems with the standards when they tried to do that is that you would have a gold standard and a silver standard. They would be pegged in a way, but the peg was unnatural and one would get wrecked. You would either, some people would make too much money or credit would freeze up because of the two, you trying to use these two things that are unnaturally pegged together.
Yeah. Hang on. I'm going to steel man this argument for a second. Using the gold and silver example, and let's say they're not pegged together. There's a good reason to have silver because of the physical size of the silver coin. Like if your gold was too small, like you can't physically see it anymore. So you need a less valuable coin so that you can carry it around. You can physically see it. And we don't really have this problem in Bitcoin because it's all digital and you can just divide it in extremely small and you can see the decimal just as well as you can see, you know, the left side of the decimal. But is there any similar kind of, is there anything similar to that where we would need two coins in the digital age?
I think there's an argument to be made because basically it was a lack of divisibility in gold, right?
Right.
Like you could only divide it down so small before it became A, arbitrary, and B, hard to verify. Like the only thing you can do is like gold plate something, but that makes it even more difficult to tell how much it is. Yeah. And also it's a whole lot more work in the currency, and now you're having to value the metal in it. You know, it just becomes another complicated mess. So I would say if there was an allegorical like comparison in the cryptocurrency space, and this was actually why when Litecoin first came out, there was like a little bit of like, huh, maybe that could work.
Yeah.
Was if transaction fees are expected to be high, like that you could have a less secure coin that has lower transaction fees, that basically does more, does higher volume at the base layer, and in doing so, deals with much lower lower risk and or like lower value payments. Like all the 10-cent payments happen with Litecoin or something like that. But I think that's, I think it's ridiculous now trying to justify that, because what you're talking about is a trade-off in security and a trade-off in trust in order to accomplish lower value payments, which there are a thousand ways to do that in Bitcoin without having your 10 cent fluctuate down to 6 cents in the middle of the day with some arbitrary additional currency, and then having to deal with a massively inefficient like Forex market between two cryptocurrencies when you have no borders anymore and you have no government jurisdictions as far as money goes. And you can always get that trade-off with a sidechain, with Lightning. With,
so to answer yeah. Steve's question directly yeah. about that they switched to silver coins because gold was going to get too small, this is mm-hmm. the exact reason for Dogecoin.
Yeah.
That Doge mm-hmm. can be paired against worthless assets because in a way that Bitcoin cannot because of issues with dust. So Doge actually does have a functional purpose in the same way that gold was getting too small to be a coin. Doge is actually the most useful the only other useful currency as a currency. There might be alternative blockchains, but the only other currency that has a usage is Dogecoin.
Yeah. If there is anything, like, I don't agree with that at all, but if there is anything that can be like another currency, if there's going to be a second one and all the other ones are going to fall away, I really do hope it's Doge. Doge would be the best one for it to actually happen, because it was created as a joke. Like, it's not the same like get rich quick scheme like nonsense. Like, it was literally just like, look, I made a stupid coin. And like Doge is the only other one that I think is half honest. Like, I think all the other ones are just like nonsense, and just straight up scams. Like, somebody was just like, I'm gonna make $1 billion with this. I don't think though that
you're denying the reality for ideology. Like, the reason that the shittiest exchanges.
Why don't you ask me why I'm denying it? Keep going.
There we go.
Well, the shittiest exchanges.
We're helping, guy.
The shittiest exchanges offer Dogecoin as a pair for certain currencies because they can't pair it to Bitcoin. Because the currency wouldn't flow if they paired it to Bitcoin. They had to find another currency that would actually pair to it. And that's why the worst coins in the world are traded with Doge, because Bitcoin just does not function as a currency for those coins.
You're talking about because of the low value. Well, if all of those exchanges integrated Lightning, how would that change?
They would never be able to get off the Lightning network.
Hasn't there been some, I'm not arguing with you, guy, but hasn't there been mm-hmm. some recent findings that micropayments on Lightning are not actually as easy as we thought they were because of something about opening and closing and load balancing or something like that?
It's about the degree of trust. Okay. They're not as trustless as we thought they are.
All right.
But
that's the same thing with Dogecoin.
But we know that. Like, yeah. that's still the argument, is that we'll take that trust trade-off. But like, I can still settle a 1 sat payment, and technically I can settle a 0.01 sat payment over my Lightning channel. It just means that I have a higher degree. The person doing the transacting has a higher degree of trust, and I have a higher degree of trust with the actual routing of the payment, because I'm holding on to an HTLC that's kind of it's worthless to me. You know, if I had to take it to the chain because of this payment, like one that was 1 Satoshi, like, oh, Jesus Christ, I got to close a whole channel like during a dispute over 1 Satoshi. Like, I would just throw it away. You know, I wouldn't even want it. So because of that, there's always a trust trade-off, but it doesn't make it not work with low value payments. It just means that low value payments are inherently, you're trusting when the transaction is little, you have to trust.
Okay.
I'd like to just go back to my Doge point, which is that there's a problem in Bitcoin called ideology. And I'll go to the English definition of ideology so you can understand the problem with ideology.
Okay.
Ideology is a form of social or political philosophy in which the practical elements are as prominent as theoretical ones. It is a system of ideas to explain the world and to change it. But the important idea here is that the practical elements are as prominent as the theoretical ones. Your theoretical exchange using Lightning somehow trumps my real exchange that uses Doge. And that's the problem with ideology. Mm. Either implement it or it's not real. Deny reality because of your theoretical ideas.
Well, if we're talking about that, then you're suggesting that I can't say that we will tend toward like one currency because there's 6,000 and something of them right now. Because that's the reality.
It's still just a theory.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. But it is the argument that I'm making. And I do think there is evidence in history to back that up. And I think it applies the same to Doge as it does to the other ones. Because, I mean, you could also say that, like, you know, DeFi is like a thing. And a lot of people are using it. And you can't do it on Bitcoin the way they're doing it on Ethereum. So, like, inevitably, Ethereum will be the one thing that DeFi exists for. You know, I would then turn around and make the argument that like DeFi is making a yield off of printing new tokens and suckering new people to come in to buy these tokens that aren't actually worth anything. They're just being printed to give somebody yield, and that this gig is going to go up. Like you're just not going to keep making percentages on something that doesn't actually do anything for anybody. I mean, some people are actually taking out a loan and getting paid yield, which is just batshit. Like, that is unsustainable. And, you know, I can make that argument, and eventually it will blow up. But, you know, that might not go in line with what it looks like today. Look, right today, it looks like DeFi is doing great.
Is there a coin that's called Yield?
No, it's like Compound is the coin. I mean, shit, there might be a coin named Yield. Who knows? Yield coin. Hey, watch this be a fucking coin.
On a related topic, guy, I set up an instance of BTC Pay server on DigitalOcean today, and I noticed that it shipped with Dogecoin support. There was like six coins that it comes shipped with. One of them's Dogecoin.
Can we eventually get these the old episodes of this podcast up on the Lightning Network Pay thing? You know what I'm talking about?
Ellen Pay for like Tim's thing.
Yeah, let's just, like, we should just put our archive behind there.
Okay. Well, I mean, like, it's on Anchor.fm right now, so Anchor just distributes all of our episodes to everyone. I'm not sure how I would have to tell Anchor to hide certain episodes and then put them behind a secret URL. I don't know. I don't know if Anchor would let me do that.
I think it would be a fun partnership with LN Pay to be like, encourage people each episode to go check out our archives, you know, drop some money, get a seat, you know, just promote it that way.
That would be cool.
That would be cool. Hey, did you guys see that Blue Wallet? Did Blue Wallet integrate Ellen Pay, Tim's thing?
Ellen Pay? Really? No. Did they?
Well, okay.
Hold on a second.
Wait, what's
they just integrated with Kobo Vault, because I just finally got my Kobo Vault to work and I connected it to my Blue Wallet.
Okay. Is Tim's thing called Ellen URL Pay now?
I didn't think it changed. I thought it was just Ellen Pay still.
Okay, well, I got a release that Blue Wallet has now integrated LNURL-Pay. I don't know if that's pay. Tim's thing renamed or not.
LNURL.
LNURL-Pay. Oh, okay. Maybe this.
Oh, it's the name of the actual LNURL protocol. The actual GitHub, like, thing is LNURL-Pay. So no, they're just saying that they just integrated LNURL. so that you can have like a two-way, you can scan a QR that goes either direction. It gives you a key send address or requests 100 Satoshis or pays you 100 Satoshis, whatever. It just gives you a URL with all the relevant data to it.
Oh, okay.
So cool. No, yeah, that's not Tim's thing. God, that would be freaking awesome, though. I'd have been like, how the hell did I miss that?
Yeah, now, okay.
Guys, I'm seeing on recent paywalls that someone uploaded Playboy South Africa January 2020.
What?
I have a short list of suspects for who's uploading South African Playboys.
Yes.
But also,
I can neither confirm nor deny that's happening.
Oh man,
I'm very tempted to get this though.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with, I'm sure as a guy knows, like, you know, making lightning payments per episode of a podcast is just like you have to have the platform integrate that service for you. It's not like something you can do on your own very easily. All right. Anybody got any more topics?
I think we just hit a hard wall.
Hit a hard wall.
Sorry, I was checking stuff on my phone. I was hunting around for Ellen Pay stuff. Oh man! Crap! It's late. I got here late today.
One thing I will say,
totally forgot about it.
There is, he did do the sovereign individual. He got out of the United States. You know, that's what the book says so explicitly. Someone like Peter Thiel says that the sovereign individual, changed his life. He's not living in the U.S. He immigrates here and now works with our CIA. So there are certain people that actually get the sovereign individual. And there's certain people that are just, you know, again, virtue signaling about it.
You think most Bitcoiners get it, or do you think most Bitcoiners are signaling?
I don't think most Bitcoiners care about freedom as much as they care about luxury.
Mm.
And I think there's a luxury incentive to stay in the United States, even as things go very badly.
Yeah.
I think you'll be able to fund your own army pretty easily if you have a couple of Bitcoin in the United States.
Yeah. Oh, I've got one kind of last topic. This there was a podcast with this guy that's developing the Passport hardware wallet. Have you guys heard about this?
Yes.
Hardware wallet.
That I'm really excited about this.
Yeah. So he's starting with the cold card software or firmware. So it's built off cold card firmware, and it's definitely focused on the QR code as the air-gapped mechanism for passing back and forth the signed transactions, which is what I've been waiting for. Like, to be honest, I haven't bought a cold card yet because I'm just waiting for the QR code communication protocol. I just hate plugging shit in, man.
I love that about the – that's the one thing that I really like about the Kobo Vault is – it's just air gap like that. And both of the new ones that I've just recently seen are exactly like that. The Passport, fully air gap. It's just a screen and a camera. And then I just stumbled upon another one. Hold on a second. Let me check real quick. Golden Elipaltian cold storage hardware wallet. It's straight up. It looks like a phone here. I'll
really
get you the link. I'll post it in the chat here so y'all can check it out.
Okay. So, like, if this happened, I would start, like, in-person meetups again, like, showing people how to use these things because...
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think that's going to be a big deal.
We just need in-person meetups regardless.
These things look good. Yeah, that's true. Like, they're looking classy. And to have it come from like looking like a kind of bizarre, like cypherpunk little hardware thing to like straight up looking like a phone, like looking like really clean, really sleek, like really professional. I think that's really, really exciting to me. Like, I'm super happy to see the next generation of these things.
The Kobo Vault is probably the best hardware wallet I've ever used.
It's great, really? Isn't it? Fantastic. It's really nice. I had a huge problem with it right at the beginning because the original firmware, the keyboard was just unusable because it has the, you know, digital keyboard.
Yeah.
I literally couldn't type in my password. I tried it like 40 times.
I had no issue with that whatsoever.
I finally, after fighting with it originally and being like, oh God, this is painful, because it was such a cool idea and it was such a slick device. I was like, oh, this is going to be great. But then I kind of gave up on it. And then was like, okay, I'll update the firmware later. And then I just procrastinated. I finally got to it like 2 days ago or something. And I broke through it and got it. And it works. It works great. And I love being able to just connect with the QR code. Like, so I've just, like, my wallet, like, I've never, so easy, just scan with my wallet, and now my wallet is watching my addresses for the hardware wallet. And then if I want to sign, I give it the QR code from my actual phone wallet, and then sign it and, you know, hit okay or whatever on the vault, and then it gives me the finished QR code, I re-scan it, boom, broadcast transaction, and totally air-gapped. It's awesome. It's a great process.
So the Kobo Vault wallet itself has a camera also.
Has a camera and a big screen.
Sensor. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Wow. Have
you tried to update that wallet yet? The most annoying thing to me about hardware wallets is it is such a pain and terrifying to download and install new software when they release updates.
Yeah.
So what I like about the Kobo Vault is that, you know, In practical reality, there is no reason to upgrade because you're just signing signatures. You're just scanning QR codes. So if you are comfortable with it and you never upgraded your phone, or at least you didn't for the next couple of years, you would have, there would be no reason to do it. I've ordered three more. I mean, I'm never going back to a Ledger. Trezor, I think it's a pale comparison.
Wow.
This is great. I'm going to get a Kobo Vault.
That article, the thing I was talking about earlier with the mining, Steve, and the difference between the software and the hardware guys. I think this is the one that I'm referring to. And it's read 69. So 400, damn near 400 episodes, maybe actually a little bit of change ago. And it's called The State of Cryptocurrency Mining. Okay. And it talks about a whole bunch of other stuff, ASIC resistance versus that's, you know, how ridiculous that idea actually is, you know, like all of this stuff. I would check that one out. There's some really interesting pieces in that. That's one of the best pieces I've read on mining.
Really? Okay.
On the whole show, to be honest.
I'll check that out. Oh, I found one last topic. All right. Do you guys feel like we're living in some golden age and like where it's easy to obtain Bitcoin, like before the global shortage of Bitcoin, where like, isn't there a chance that it's just going to be hilarious to tell our grandkids how we used to get Bitcoin?
Yeah.
I guess I'm not phrasing this right. You know what I mean? Though?
Yeah. There's specific ages. We're probably not in the golden age. Overall, we're in the heroic age.
Heroic age.
I'm pulling up. So the Greece people invented these concepts. I can't find it. But essentially, you start out with just the gods living around, and then things get worse in the second age. Things get worse in the third age. The heroic age is like the one time where you like make progress again. So it's not the very start, but it's the one time when you actually like push back against the decline. And then the fifth age is when everything falls apart and you return to chaos.
I love this optimism coming from Papa Frita. So we're living in a heroic age right now.
I've been reading The Sovereign Individual. He doesn't say this out loud, but like he named three preceding ages. The fourth age is the heroic age, as far as the Greeks understood it.
Oh, okay, nice. So you're agreeing with Sovereign Individual so far?
the sovereign individual is like getting tons of stuff right. It's like completely spiritually empty and like it's so defeatist and just like let the bad guys win. Let just hordes of evil people run around and bully. Don't put up any resistance. That's the mistake of it. But overall, these guys are good conspiracy theorists. They're getting access to information that's getting leaked out by intelligence agencies, as well as conjecturing based on kind of obvious trends. The big thing I say right now is if you don't know that we're about to start wars in South America, you're not paying attention. If you don't know we're pivoting from the Middle East to South America, you just don't know anything. You could write a book and really impress people with that sort of information. Doing that at the time. They were very predictive. They specifically call out a COVID-type situation for like a paragraph in the book as just something they weren't like specifically highlighting, but it's like this is one thing that could go wrong that we're not going to examine. Because they think, you know, geography and was one of the big things, as well as viruses and stuff really shaped history a lot. But
gotcha.
But his assessment is good.
When was Sovereign Individual written in again? 1990 something?
Here's the problem with the United States, which is like, he doesn't say this is the problem, but the United States is a European colony. And if you want to look at what's going wrong with the United States, it's what happened with every post-colonial society, in that your post-colonial society, once you're freed from European rule, you just start impersonating Europe. But it's not natural. It's not natural when Pakistan achieved independence that it decided to create a European elite, a European giant bureaucracy to try to manage the mass of peasants. This doesn't work. But we've got the same thing in the United States. We've got Harvard and Yale pretending to be Oxford and Cambridge, trying to, with a giant government corporate bureaucracy, trying to manage all the workers, but that's a terrible system that does not work. And it definitely does not work in the United States, in America, where it doesn't fit our history at all. Like, Europeans are used to having a sovereign. They're used to having a giant bureaucracy around the king. It doesn't make sense here. And that's why people are so miserable, is that we have a European system ruling a country that's not Europe. And that was the initial betrayal of our founding fathers, is that you have this revolutionary moment. There are people that want to impersonate where the place you just freed from. There are people that want to create a new system, and the people that just wanted to impersonate England won. And the people that came to America to get away from Europe. Yet the elites are just trying to be Europe. And now it's gotten to be way too much.
This is like when some Bitcoiners tried to recreate the old financial system inside of Bitcoin. Is that a good analogy?
It is. Yeah, it's a recurring pattern that just tends to happen, is that you do you guys know what the invisible hand is? Like, we all heard of it, but could you actually explain what it is?
I feel like I know what it is. It's like just the thing that makes supply and demand and prices just what they are, because that's what the people need.
That's not the invisible hand. I thought that was the invisible hand as well. But what happened in America is we've all confused the invisible hand with laissez-faire, because they're both hand things. The invisible hand is the idea that people will want what other people have. So if you see somebody walking around with a Rolex, you'll start wanting a Rolex.
You talking about John Locke's hand?
Oh, I hate that.
Invisible hand thing, because... That's not how I've heard it referred to. Whose specific use of this?
Yeah, it's Adam Smith.
I mean, excuse me, Adam Smith. Thank you. That's how he referred to the invisible hand.
Yeah. Laissez-faire and invisible hand are two different things.
Okay, because I'd always heard the way like Hayek put it. Whenever it was referenced, the invisible hand was just the fact that all of this knowledge was orchestrated. Kind of the example was, you know, let's say there's a bunch of copper mines in Chile, and then there's a giant earthquake and it shuts down like, you know, half the copper production. Well, then the price of copper would raise all across the US and Russia, everywhere across the world. And all of these people would choose to, you know, put, you know, some other metal or whatever in their wires or use some sort of alternative. They would all stop using as much copper as they were before because the price had risen, and that it was as if an invisible hand was directing them to change their behavior in the light of new information, and that the invisible hand was the fact that this knowledge was spread, even though not a soul had to know anything about the fact that there was an earthquake in Chile. That's how I had heard it referenced, but to be perfectly honest, I don't know Smith recently. So it could be.
Sorry, yeah, I think the different people have, it hasn't stuck with the original definition, but that was his original definition. I definitely do not think he was referring to commodities as an invisible hand. I think it's more of like, it's almost more of a primal thing that if you see somebody successful wearing a cool looking shirt, you kind of want that same shirt. Like you're just going to impersonate success. You're going to impersonate, you're going to be jealous. So it's like a mimicry of sorts, what the invisible hand is. And that's why people can show, it has to do with trade of, you know, when somebody came back to Europe with a raccoon hat, how are you going to make a market for a raccoon hat? That makes no sense. You know, you would think that person would just be a fool, but for some reason, seeing that guy with a raccoon hat, other people who had never seen a raccoon hat were like, I need to get myself a raccoon hat. That's the invisible hand, is that there's a natural, that's where the demand for just new products comes from. But that, I could be wrong.
That feels more like the invisible greed or something. I mean, keep the invisible keeping up with the Joneses.
That sounds a little bit, it's a little bit akin to part of the animal spirits argument, actually. Is that, you know, a lot of our desires and wants and stuff are just borrowed from other people. It's just like, I just want that because that other person wanted it. Which, I mean, is actually exists, like social pressure and desires. But I think those are naturally the more frivolous of the things. Like what you're actually buying in those instances are reputation, social influence or whatever, because in the end we are social beings, you know. Like I don't think that's, if somebody else buys, if everybody in the neighborhood has a watch and you like, I now desire a watch, I don't think it's because the value of that watch is determined by, I don't think it really has anything to do with the watch, because if everybody's wearing a particular hat, you might want the hat. It's in the same way that you'll pay to go out to a movie with a bunch of people. Like you want to belong. You want to be part of a social group. You're a social being and you want to interact and speak the same language as these people. And that is a form of being included in your social group. You've got it posted here. The theory is that the invisible hand states that if each consumer is allowed to choose freely what to buy, and each producer is allowed to choose freely what to sell and how to produce it, the market will settle on a product distribution and prices that are beneficial to all the individual members of a community, and hence to the community as a whole. The reason for this is that self-interest drives actors to beneficial behavior in a case of serendipity. Efficient methods of production are adopted to maximize profits. Low prices are charged to maximize revenue through gain in market share by undercutting competitors. Citation needed. Investors invest in those industries most urgently needed to maximize return and withdraw capital from those less efficient in creating value. All these effects take place dynamically and automatically. Penis, penis, penis.
Reddit.
Well, one of the interesting things about Adam Smith and why we don't talk about him in this country is the great Adam Smith scholars, for some reason, write in French and it doesn't get translated. So the people that actually understand what he's talking about, he's impossible to read. The people that actually have been studying this for the last, you know, century have all been writing in French and it's all stuck in French. We still need that Babel Fish breakthrough where we can actually read all these other languages, and then society will just explode in efficiency for a little while once we do that. That'll be as big as the Industrial Revolution. Hmm. As big as the information age hasn't really taken off when we can't read other languages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about this signaling about, you know, our economic status, keeping up with the Joneses stuff when I was riding my bike today. I think it's weird how nobody rides bikes around here. Like, there's bike lanes. It's great. Paul rides a bike. Yeah. But I was like, it's crazy that no one rides bikes around Raleigh. And it occurred to me that when you ride a bike, you signal that you're poor. And so, like, if someone has the ability to ride a bike or drive a car, they're probably subconsciously thinking of, like, how do I want to be seen when I arrive at the grocery store? You know, it's like, we don't, and it's the same thing goes with the thing I talked about before with, like, oh, leisure. People don't want to signal that they have leisure. No one wants to signal that they have free time. Because that's not like signaling that you are really an important and influential person in society. And so it's like, these are the things that go into people's decisions about whether to drive the car or ride a bike. It's not about like health or fitness or exercise or gas money or anything like that. And this is why, like, no one's actually going to want a life of leisure. Because they're not going to look like they're important, influential people. I feel like we have that theory backwards, that people actually want leisure.
I think there's potentially an element of that. I mean, without a doubt, I think I know people like that. But I think that's actually a consequence of like for the biking thing, I think probably a more significant factor, and again, this is just me completely speculating, but it's the humidity of North Carolina that prevents more of that than it's just us being unbelievably used to being comfortable. And not caring about the fact that there's a lot of energy that goes with that. Now, I would definitely say there are people who I either know of or are incredibly easy to imagine that would be offended to be like, I have to ride a bike to the grocery store. Like, I think that element absolutely exists, but I don't know if I would call it, I don't know if I would think it was a dominant element in that. And then the idea of leisure, I think that's just downwind from culture. And I think our culture is so bass-ackwards today because of how bad our money is. Yeah, like we don't know what value and investment is. We have no idea how to value our time. And we've been on a 50-year treadmill, like on a hamster wheel of just churning and churning to stay at zero.
I know. You know? But that's how people show that they're important now. I mean, how many times do you hear people getting made fun of for having too much time on their hands? You know, like that's an insult to tell someone they have too much time on their hands.
This happens to me at the office all the time. I hate it. It's the bane of my existence. It's
I just sit around and read Bitcoin all day.
Yeah, like my response is about something that I read in a book, and they're like, "Where do you find time to read all this book? And like, all these books? Like, I just don't have time to do any of that stuff." don't you have kids? Don't you? Like, yes.
So but busy.
I hate it so much. Honestly, you know, going back
I'm so busy, and I'm better than you.
Yeah, Papa Frito said this earlier. It's like, what age are we in? I am convinced that the Age of Heroes has ended, and whatever the next one is, that's where we're at. It's fucking deplorable human beings just sucking the humanity out of us all. It doesn't matter what you do to educate people or try to help them or explain anything. People don't want a hand up. They want a hand out. And that has never been truer than it has been with knowledge. They don't even value it anymore. Unless you can give them some life-breaking motivational fucking poster, it's just worthless. If it doesn't come easy, not interested in it. That's probably my biggest fucking complaint of being a Bitcoiner and trying to tell people there's something to be interested in. Just people don't give a shit, not unless it's easy.
To be perfectly honest, I think that's, again, downwind from culture. I think, tell me about a kid. What 5-year-old doesn't love to question why?
Yeah.
Why is that lost when you're 15?
School.
Yeah.
Like, I think school beats it, beats that shit out of us. And we literally trap ourselves into a mental box until we are just taught to avoid and hate thinking about things. But I don't think it's natural. I think it's a consequence of a really messed up system and us being at the very end of it. That it's just so bloated and it's imploding. And that's when everybody squeals the loudest and is most hateful about the fact that I have to think about something and I have to change things because things aren't turning out the way I am. And I'm just going to be mad at the world because things should be the way I think they are. Like, it's just, we're all having to come to terms with the fact that reality is not the bullshit we've been fed, and everybody hates it. So we hate each other right now.
You know, on this journey, I think the part that I'm dreading the most about it is that when Bitcoin goes above $100,000, and there is this moment where we're all going to look at each other and we're going to get on this thing. We're not going to record it. And we're going to say, guys, I'm depressed. I had another moment where they wanted and expected me to say, I told you so. And I just can't say it anymore. I just can't do it anymore. I need to go see a therapist. This is too much money. It's too much responsibility. And I'm sick and tired of the people being so eager for more handouts when I tried for a fucking decade to tell them about it and got laughed out of every fucking cocktail party. Or insert your own, you know, event of your choosing. Maybe not cocktail party, but whatever.
They were all cocktail parties for me.
Exactly. When you're a Bitcoiner, everything's a cocktail party. Yeah,
what another great reason that we have these recorded there. It's like, oh, you don't think I spent 10 years trying to convince people? They're all on anchor.fm.
Yep.
So to follow up on, if you believe we're in the last age, you believe we're in the Iron Age, and this age is humans live in an existence of toil and misery, children dishonor their parents, brother fights with brother, the social contract between guest and host is forgotten. During this age, might makes right. Bad man use lies to be thought good. At the height of this age, humans no longer feel shame or indignation at wrongdoings. Babies will be born with gray hair, and the gods will have completely forsaken humanity.
Oh my God.
There was a lady in Raleigh that
she took that there.
The lady in Raleigh that shat on the floor in a Starbucks and threw it at someone. We've lost human dignity. Like this.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a strong case that this is the Iron Age. I could tell you my personal beliefs about what happens is after the Iron Age, you kind of have to just go back to the kind of everything resets in some sort of miraculous way, and you go back to the Golden Age. I think that's kind of the way the cycle starts over is kind of with a Adam and Eve scenario where someone has the fruit of knowledge, everybody tastes it, you become banished from this world and you get to the next world. That's what I think. That's what I think we could play out if you actually do think we're in the Iron Age.
No, I totally agree. I think we're at the end of a very imbalanced cycle. But I think we're on the verge of a new enlightenment age. Like, of the people that, like, do suddenly start having an interest and, like, start asking me about it, like, I see them get excited about thinking about things in a way that they've possibly haven't done in years. Like, they literally are stopping and thinking about a thing, like having to learn something that they don't know and is unfamiliar to them and makes them look at something they thought they knew, particularly learning about how the monetary system works and stuff, and just see something completely different. And with the birth of, like, the long form audio format, like all of these different avenues for creativity and stuff, like I think we just kind of have a real cultural mess on our hands in this transition out of the old world. But I truly think in 20, 30 years, we will be, I think we're at the cusp of a new age of enlightenment, really.
I think even age of enlightenment is understating it. We have been serfs since the dawn of time. We have been ruled since the dawn of time by people who were more violent than us. From the dawn of time, we don't remember any period before that. There's no written record of a period where we weren't just subjects of somebody else. That's the end of that's the true end. That's the true reset. As if we can ever get out of it. I don't know. It has to happen in America or it has to happen in China. So those are really your two options.
Papa Frito, there was a quote I was going to bring up earlier based on something you said, and it's from Frederick Douglass. And it basically says, knowledge makes a man unfit to be a slave.
Yeah.
And I mean, I feel that sentiment quite a bit and yeah, sympathize with it.
Yeah. Love that quote. All right. I actually think I need to head out on this one.
I love ending this with Papa Frito being so optimistic about.
It's a rare thing that we get.
The world. It's great.
Love it. Love it. Good stuff.
It's a cycle, guys. I you know, we're at one part of the cycle. It never stops. You look at a different part of the cycle, you'll be optimistic. You look at a different part, you'll be sad. But
hey, does the cycle get your ass back on Telegram anytime soon?
I have felt so good since leaving Telegram. The best thing you can ever do is stop using any app.
Yeah.
It's the best thing you can do for your psychological health. It's better than exercise. Delete an app.
I spend way too much time on my phone.
It's addictive. One thing you can do that, like, so it's addictive. They're specifically hiring psychologists to make them addictive with the noises, with the animation, with the colors. At a bare minimum, what you can do to make the stuff less addictive is to switch your screen to black and white. And this messes up all of the subliminal things that are making you more addicted to the app. You're just getting the actual information. You're not getting little shots of serotonin from every time a page flips and a color lights up. And all those.
Good suggestion. All right, guys. It's been a good one.
Yeah, man.
Next week.
All right.
You guys have for a while.
Catch y'all later.
Just.